taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. Now, I know you can't tell this because, well, this is radio, but I am standing with my hand over my heart, and I am saluting the men, the women, who today and in our past have pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to protect the Constitution, to protect this nation against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That's right. Today is Veterans Day, a day when we remember those who have served and have served honorably. And I want to take some time today, and I want to honor those who have served. I want to honor their vigor, their valentry. I want to honor the idea of service, the idea of sacrifice, the idea of giving of oneself in honor of your country. Now, sadly, America hasn't always had a good reputation when it comes to honoring those who serve. Sometimes we have taken our political angst, our frustration out on those who have served. We may disagree with where they were sent into service, but it is a sad fact that we dishonor their service when we conflate them following orders with a political decision, the political decision of those that are put in power. We aren't led by a military. The military isn't led by military leaders. Ultimately, the military is led by civilians. And very often, we blame those who serve for the mistakes of the civilians. Very often, the mistakes are inflicted on those who serve. And I want to talk a bit about that today, but mostly I want to honor those people who serve, and I want to honor the services, which is why I started out today with the Army song. I want to honor each of the branches as we look at the constitutional aspects of those military branches. Now, I'm sure many of you are aware that the president is the commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy and other militias when they're called into actual service. That's Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1. But it's important to remember, first of all, he's the commander-in-chief. That basically means he's the top general. It doesn't mean he sets the rules for them. It's that they, you know, when they are in service, when you've got, we have an army, we have a navy, they are ultimately led by one person, the President of the United States. But we should never forget that it is ultimately Congress's responsibility to set the rules for the military. Article 1, Section 8, I believe it's Clause 14, says Congress has the power to make rules for the government and regulations of the land and naval forces. So while the president is a commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy, it's ultimately Congress that sets the rules by which those forces operate. And we call it today the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I believe we find that in Title 10 of the United States Code. So let's start with this basic information. The land and naval forces, yes, they report to the president, but the president isn't dictator over the military. The president is there to execute the laws of the United States. That includes the laws that Congress makes to regulate, to govern the land and naval forces of the United States. That means that the president doesn't get to do whatever he wants with the military. He's enacting the laws, the legitimate laws of the United States. So yes, the those in the military, they tend to follow the orders of their leaders, of their commanders, unless they believe them to be unlawful, and they have to have, you know, some just cause to believe they're unlawful. So we tend to defer a lot of power to the President of the United States, and that comes with a lot of pomp and a lot of circumstance. But we need to never forget that ultimately it is Congress that sets the rules for the military. Now, the Army originally, remember when we started this country in 1788, this Constitution, and actually 1789 when the government went into effect, we basically had just had two military forces. You had an army and you had a navy. And the army tended to deal with land fighting and the navy dealt with, well, water fighting. The one exception is we have a Marine Corps, which is basically the Navy's land forces. We'll talk a bit more about the Marines a little later in the program. But we've always had an army and we've always had a navy. And we've asked them to do quite a few things. Now, there are a couple of unique things about the army. Probably the first is that it falls under what's called posse comitatus. Now, many of you may be familiar with the term posse comitatus. It often gets misrepresented, but Title 18, United States Code, Section 1385, states, whoever, except in cases and under circumstances expressly authorized by the Constitution or Act of Congress, willfully uses any part of the Army or the Air Force as a posse comitatus or otherwise to execute the laws shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. So first, what is a posse comitatus and why is it focused on the Army and the Air Force? Well, posse comitatus is Latin for power of the country. So what we're dealing here with is, you know, this idea of, okay, before anybody can use the Army or Air Force as the power of the country or in any way to execute the laws of the United States, it has to fall under the Constitution or an act of Congress. So again, President is the commander in chief, but federal law prevents him from using either the Army or the Air Force to execute the laws of the nation or generally to act as the power of the nation, except as authorized by the Constitution and an act of Congress. We think of this mostly as a prohibition against using the military to enforce laws of the United States on United States soil. So in other words, when you see, you know, we think often like the National Guard being brought out to enforce laws of the United States, but the Army and the Air Force specifically are not, which gets into a very interesting question. Why the Army and the Air Force and not the Navy? Well, partially, I believe the Air Force was included because originally the Air Force was part of the Army. What we now call the Air Force, originally the Army Air Corps, up through World War II, during World War I and World War II, was simply a part of the Army. When it was created as a separate branch of government, it was, I believe the Posse Comitatus Act was amended to include the Air Force to it. But why not the Navy? Why not the naval forces? We'll talk about that as I get more into the naval forces of the United States, but it's important to recognize that the Army is prohibited, except by an act of Congress, to enforce U.S. law. In other words, you can't have the army platoons, army regiments in the United States patrolling and enforcing laws. It's very important. Remember, during the colonial times, law was enforced by the British military. We don't have that in the United States. Now, it's not to say there aren't any military forces that will ever enforce the law, but we specifically said, you know, there are things we're not going to let the Army do. One of them is enforce the law, except as authorized by an act of Congress. Another interesting constitutional uniqueness revolving the Army is Article 1, Section 8, Clause, I think it's 11 or 12, says Congress has the power to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to use to that use shall be for longer than term of 2 years. So Congress, you know, we talk about Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, Congress has the ability to lay and collect taxes for the common defense. One of the things those taxes can be used for is to raise and support armies. But again, there's some eccentricities. The army, the ability to raise money for an army cannot be for longer than 2 years. And the way it is worded in the Constitution, it specifically says to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for longer than two terms. Over the years, this army and military have rather become muddled in our understanding, muddled in our common definitions, the way we think of these entities. Armies are specifically, as defined by the Free Legal Dictionary, a large body of people organized and trained for land warfare. Now, why is this important? Well, again, the Constitution says we cannot raise money for armies for more than, you know, appropriate money for armies for more than 2 year term at a time. We don't want a standing army. We were repressed under a standing army when we were colonies. We didn't want that to happen. It is one of the reasons why the civilian leadership, the present United States, is the commander in chief. It's one of the reasons why before someone like an Eisenhower or a Grant was able to serve as president, they had to resign their commission in the military, in the army. We did not want a military leadership over the military. We ultimately wanted it to be civilian. And you know, so that's, and in understanding the limitations Congress places, it says we cannot raise funds for an army for more than 2 year term at a time. Specifically stating armies, meaning the land forces. Dealt with the army. What about the navy? I think it's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 13 says that Congress has the ability to provide and maintain a navy. That's it. See, unlike the appropriations for a army, there is no 2 year time limit on providing for and maintaining a navy. Unlike the Army and the Air Force, posse comitatus doesn't apply to the Navy. Now, Congress, again, still has to make rules for governing, regulating both the land and naval forces, right? So it's still under the auspices of Congress to make the rules. The president is the commander-in-chief, but the rules are set by Congress that the president has to follow. But why are the navies different? Why is the Navy different? Well, again, part of it comes from our history, from where our founding fathers looked at it and said, we need a navy. Most of the country in 1788, had a coastline. Most of the states had a coastline, and those coasts needed to be defended. We wanted a military force that could defend us. So why do we not have a 2 year limitation on funding a navy? Well, in the 18th century, what you needed for an army was uniforms, ammunition, and supplies. You didn't need a long-term investment for, at least it's my opinion, for an army. You want to raise an army, what you need is you needed to acquire They had to have, they're supposed to have uniforms. You have to raise, firearms for them, ammunition, provisions. Those are all short-term investments. In the 18th century, we got to get cloth. We got to make those. A Navy, on the other hand, is different. You see, you can't simply say, okay, we're going to build a ship, and then in 2 years, maybe the ship goes away, maybe it doesn't. There's a long-term investment in a Navy. And again, we're still talking 18th century. We're talking wooden boats. I don't know how long, a naval ship takes to build back in the 1800s. I don't know how long that took. Had to take at least months. So if you're, and you expect it to function for years, if you appropriate funds for 1,000 soldiers, you buy ammunition, well, okay, they can walk away without the ammunition, but we needed people with long-term experience to deal with the Navy, which is my opinion why the naval forces don't have that 2-year appropriations limitation on them. It's why we can invest billions of dollars to build ships and aircraft carriers and submarines and stuff with where it takes many, many, many years, sometimes 3, 4, 5 years to develop and even just to build an aircraft carrier or a nuclear submarine. Because unlike the armies, the Navy doesn't have that 2-year limitation. Now, again, because we deal with bureaucracies and how do we make life easier for ourselves, the politicians have bundled all of the military funding into the National Defense Authorization Act, or the NDAA. So in effect, the Navy still goes through a 2-year appropriation cycle, not because the Constitution requires it, but for the convenience of the politicians. Besides, they like having the NDAA because it's considered must-pass legislation, so they like to load it up with stuff that has nothing to do with the military because they know anybody who votes against the NDAA is going to be pilloried for not supporting the military, and that's just political suicide. It's a little bit of political chicanery, but that's where we sit at the moment. That's the status of funding in the United States. But again, I want to go back to the fact that the Navy is not only not held to that 2-year limitation of appropriations, but the Navy is not included in the Posse Comitatus Act. Remember, so it says Army and Air Force. And again, that's interesting because it means that the Navy is legally authorized to enforce laws of the United States while at sea. Now, again, there's probably international treaties about national waters and how far out they can go, but it does mean that the Navy can, intercept drug smugglers and arrest them, seize their cargo, and otherwise enforce the laws of the United States without violating Posse Comitatus, because the Navy and the naval forces have a slightly different set of rules than the Army or the land forces. But of course, that brings up another thing I want to talk a bit more about later, and that's talk about the Marines, which are basically a land force for the Navy. The Marine Corps is not actually a separate branch of the military. It is a part of the Navy. It's the Navy's land forces. And I'll talk a bit more about them later on in the program. But before I do that, there is another naval force that, I guess tends to get short shrift. We don't think about it that much, but it's actually, it began shortly after the new republic, the new union was created, and that is the Coast Guard. Back even before this country, we had lighthouses, and in 1789, Congress created the lighthouse establishment. Lighthouses were necessary to protect the coast. It was to protect shipping as they came into the coast to warn them of dangerous situations. Then in 1790, Congress authorized the Secretary of the Treasury, then Alexander Hamilton, to build cutters, to build fast ships designed to protect the nation's revenue. In fact, it was called the Revenue Service or the Revenue Marine, and its purpose was to, remember, one of the things that Congress is allowed to collect taxes on are duties and imposts, monies taxed on goods coming in. They needed protection. So they created this revenue service. Then in 1863, it would officially be named the Revenue Cutter Service. And again, it dealt with lighthouses and it dealt with a protecting the revenue of the country. Then in 1848, Congress created the life-saving stations. We have what we call the life-saving service. This is the one of the things we think very much about with the Coast Guard today, and that is its purpose is to save lives on the open sea. It still isn't called the Coast Guard, so we have two services. We have the Revenue Service, and we have the life-saving service. And then finally, in 1915, the two services are merged, and we end up with the Coast Guard that we think of today. The merging of the law enforcement, the revenue service, and the life-saving service into what is today, again, called the Coast Guard. It's why the Coast Guard has these two very distinct missions. And it's, to me, it was a little bit interesting history because I never realized that. Again, you know, when you think of, at least for me, you know, when I think of the military, I think of Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, but got to remember the Coast Guard. But unlike the Army and the Navy, which were specifically called out in the Constitution, specifically like funding of armies and maintaining a Navy, we have this Coast Guard as part of the naval forces. It is, again, falls under Congress's authority under the Land and Naval Forces. I know there are some people that claim that the Coast Guard doesn't fall under it because it's armies and navies, but does say naval forces. And we see it as an interesting amalgamation of these two different goals, these two different missions. And so I just thought, personally, I thought that was interesting. I thought it was worth taking a bit of time to learn and understand these two forces. Now, again, I have two other forces to deal with, but I'm going to have to do that after I take a break. And before I take that break, I want to remind everybody to head to healthycell.com. You know, with everything going on today, keeping healthy is an important part of living a good life, a happy life, a healthy life. And we need vitamins. Now, I don't know about you, but for, you know, decades, vitamins were pills you took in the morning. My mother used to take a fistful of them every morning. I was always amazed at how many pills she would take every morning. Well, Healthy Cells redesigned it. No longer the fistful of pills. It's a travel-ready gel pack. You can take the gel directly out of the pack. You can mix it in food or water. And they're designed to give your body the nutrition it needs at the cellular level. Now, they have several different formulas, and right now I'm recording this, I'm on the road. So one of the things I know I have a problem with when I'm on the road is falling asleep. I get all wound up. So I'm using REM sleep to help me get drowsy, fall asleep, stay asleep better so I can wake up in the morning alert, awake, refreshed, and ready to go about my business, ready to go about my day. Now, you can try HealthyCell.com, but as an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order if you go to HealthyCell.com/OutLoud or if you use OutLoud at checkout. You can try any of their formulas. Like I said, I use the REM sleep to help me fall asleep, especially when I'm on the road, but you can find them for to boost your immune system, to boost your focus. They're all there for you to try. So again, go to healthycell.com/outloud for 20% off your first order. And since we were just talking about the Coast Guard, let's go out to commercial with the Coast Guard song.
I'm excited to talk about a new product from Healthy Cell, AC11. This is a patented bioactive extract of Uncaria tomentosa from the Amazon rainforest. It supports cell DNA repair and health span. It's a dietary supplement. I'm excited to try it. Many are interested in longevity and attenuation of senescence. We know that telomere length and other biologic measures are related to senescence in clinical and preclinical studies, particularly of animal models. And I can tell you as a doctor, dietary supplements do hold the promise of attenuating repair and damage in our body due to stress, physical wear and tear, sunlight, etc. And there's a tremendous opportunity for supplements to help us in this area. And so Healthy Cell has brought a product to market for you to try as part of your health portfolio. So please go to healthycell.com and in the promotional code, list out loud for 20% off your first purchase of products from Healthy Cell. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
AmericaOutloud.com. Simply put, we're patriots who believe in Ronald Reagan's vision of a shining city on a hill. From sea to shining sea, you can listen in on iHeartRadio. Our free apps are on Apple, Android, or Alexa, or our world-class media player. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. Well, you probably recognize that song. That means I'm going to talk about the Air Force next. A little interesting piece of history. When I was a teenager, I actually considered joining the military to become an aviator. I was considering a career in aviation. Wasn't sure if I was going to go into the Air Force or into the Navy. I was kind of leaning towards the Navy, but I always thought the Air Force was cool, but I couldn't fit into an F-15. At least they wouldn't let me fit into an F-15. So I also found out that I was much better at computers than I was at military discipline. So I ended up following a career in the military. But again, the Air Force has its own interesting history. Now, remember, when the Constitution was drafted, aviation was unheard of. Powered flight, lighter than air aircraft were just beginning to be played with. I believe Jefferson saw, or was it Franklin, saw their first hot air balloon in Paris. So this new endeavor, this new machine called an aircraft, wasn't considered a part of the military until 1907, and at which point they were the Signal Corps, the Aeronautical Signal Corps. Aeronautical Division Signal Corps. They were part of the Signal Corps, and their purpose was to, deliver signals, to deliver information. They were simply considered a communication device. In 1918, they became the Division of Military Aeronautics as they started seeing how planes could be used for, not just communication, but military reconnaissance, but actually to fight, to drop bombs, to use that. In 1918, they became the Air Service as part of the U.S. Army. So as I mentioned before, the Air Force is actually started off as a division of the Army. It got renamed the Air Corps, the U.S. Army Air Corps, in 1926. And then in 1941, it got renamed again to the U.S. Army Air Forces. So we see this new technology of an airplane being used in battle. This idea gets developed, and we have this this, okay, where do we stick it? We make it part of the army. It's not so much for dealing over water, it's for dealing over the land, so we stick it in the army because, well, where else are we going to stick it? But as we went through World War II and we saw the power of the airplane in military action, both in fighting and in defense, it grew. And in September of 1947, became its own branch of the government under the United States Department of Defense. Now, the National Security Act of 1947 kind of took the Army and the Navy and the Coast, took the Coast Guard, took the Army and Navy, and it brought them into the Department of Defense with this newly created Air Force. And again, the Air Force's purpose is to fight wars in the air. Air power has become a significant portion of a military engagement, and that's what the purpose of the Air Force. Now, it's always interesting because you've always got these interagency rivalries, and it exists as much in the military as anybody else. So to watch the debates, the arguments, the positioning, as someone who has, I still enjoy aviation. I still love the idea of flying. I don't fly commercially because I don't trust airlines right now, but I love to fly privately. I wish I had more time and opportunities to do that. It would be a joy to, you know, for me, but we have an Air Force specifically focused on air superiority and air combat and even air logistics. I mean, you just think about the logistics of maintaining aircraft across, maintaining any military across the world. You know, we went from biplanes where the pilot would lean out the side and drop a bomb to sophisticated fighter aircraft to different aerial missions to flying tankers, flying transports. The ability to move men and gear around the world so much faster, and the amount of what it takes to do that, not simply from a logistics standpoint, but just from a personnel standpoint. I read stories and I hear reports of air crews doing, 14, 16, 18, 20-hour sorties, flying for hours and hours and hours to get a job done. The idea of aerial refueling, of not having to take the time to land, but to hook up with a tanker in air. All of these have grown in a relatively short period of time. And, you end up with things like the SR-71 Blackbird, and we ended up, the Air Force has grown so rapidly to be such a core element of our military complex. Again, the airplane didn't exist until 1903, in a century. We had centuries of armies before we started as a nation. We had centuries of navies before we started as a nation. An Air Force is a new creation. Like I said, the airplane was created, in, as we know it, in 1903. So you're talking less than 120 years. But even just think back to 2003 and the power and capabilities that an Air Force has. The ability to, again, September 11th, when the attacks happened, what was one of the first things that the military response? Well, that was to get the Air Force, get fighters into the air to begin protecting the country from possible further attacks, even possible invasion. So these men and women do a tremendous job, often in very difficult situations. I had a friend in high school, very good friend in high school, who joined the Air Force, and to hear some of the places he went and some of the things he did and what he had to put up with. We get upset if our cell phone service dies. We get upset if the power goes out. He was in the desert, in the middle of nowhere, maintaining aircraft. so that we could fight. Originally, Saddam Hussein, I think it was the first time he went overseas, you know, but the Air Force has a rich history for such a young, not just branch, but just a young technology. They have grown into, now we have the Space Force. And I didn't find much on the Space Force yet. Again, Donald Trump just talked about it a few years ago to expand, you know, what used to be mostly the Air Force dealt with military satellites and space, and now we're splitting that off. Makes me wonder in 100 years, what is Space Force going to look like? I don't know. But the Air Force has grown so fast in technology and in capability and in importance in the planning and execution of our military plans, whether it be defense or it be offense. You know, we think of offense like the attacks on Iraq and Afghanistan. But you know, think about defense. You think about NORAD. You think about the Strategic Air Command. Again, I grew up mostly in the 1970s, in the days of the Cold War. In the days where we heard about men, most at that point, men, you didn't see many women that were stationed in the north with radars pointing, looking for ICBMs coming to kill us. That was a role of the Air Force, of the B-52 bombers, and being aloft and ready to retaliate as a mutually assured destruction, as this idea of, you don't dare punch us because we'll punch back so hard we'll both die. The Air Force very quickly became a part of that as our national strategy. It makes me curious of what the Space Force is going to do as it spins off primarily from the Air Force. And what is it going to become? What's it going to be in 100 years? I don't think any of us know. But as much as I talk about the technology, and I'm impressed by, again, SR-71, SR-72, the B-52s, the F-16s, the F-15s, it's still men and women. Those things don't work without men and women in the cockpits, and even men and women on the ground. You know, we focus on the pilots, and you think of how many hours, how many technicians it takes to maintain those aircraft. And then to maintain the logistics of how do you keep an Air Force base running? And I think we don't think about them. We don't think about it in the Army. We don't think about it in the Navy. We don't think about any of the branches. But as often as we think about our gunfighters and our fighter pilots and our men and women on ships, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of men and women that are supporting them. And I don't think we want to forget about the families as well. Now, the last branch of the military is actually not a separate branch of the military, and that's the Marine Corps. And you know, the Marines have an interesting, and I guess they have a part interesting history, part interesting mythology. On November 10th, 1775, the Continental Congress passed a resolution to raise two battalions of Marines to serve as a landing forces with the fleet. Right? So we had an Army, Navy, and Congress, you know, this Continental Congress says, even when we were still colonies, hey, the Navy still needs land forces to work with the fleet. Then in 1798, we formally, I guess, reestablish the Marine Corps as not quite a separate military branch. They're still part of the Navy, but a corps within the Navy specifically to deal with land battles. And their history and their exploits are legendary. It's funny, you know, Marines seem to have this attitude. We sometimes call them leathernecks and jarheads. and it seems like they wear those as a badge of honor. I'm sure most of us are familiar with the Marine Corps hymn, "From the Halls of Montezuma to the Shores of Tripoli," literally going back to our fighting the Barbary pirates in the late 18th century. But the last stanza, the last part, actually the last half of the last verse of that hymn is one that's I've always found interesting and impressive. I won't try to sing it for you because, well, as my wife says, I have a singing voice best left to the spoken word. But the hymn closes with, "If the army and the navy ever gaze on heaven seen, they will find the streets are guarded by United States Marines." But I find that interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it is an acknowledgement of heaven and of God. To see someone that recognizes there's something more than just this world, than just what we see here, combined with the arrogance of thinking that heaven needs to be guarded. To me, that perfectly sums up a jarhead. It perfectly sums up a leatherneck. It personally sums up what we think of when we think of a Marine. A man or woman, proud, strong. And because of their unique situation as a land force in a naval branch, Marines have some, well, that's an interesting possibilities. You think about it. You have, sure, you have the landing, the land fighting, right? You think of Marines, riflemen on the ground fighting, whether it's the Mont Suribachi, and I believe it was the Marines was doing that really raised the flag on Mount Suribachi. If I'm wrong, I'm sorry. But you think of fighting in, you know, predominantly in the Pacific and in World War II. You think about the Marine amphibious ships. They have ships. Since the Marines have land forces, they also have ships. Marines also have aircraft. A-10 Warthogs and the old F-4s. The Marine Corps seems to embrace parts of all of the other branches. We look at the Osprey, where you've got, again, helicopters and airplanes and naval engagements and land fighting. A Marine is, I guess, kind of the Swiss Army knife of the military. We have Marines that can do most of the things we ask other parts of the military to do. I suppose that's why they tend to bring a unique breed, a unique mentality to the fighting, to the military of this nation. That's the reason why I've decided to close out my program with the Marine Corps hymn. Rather than introduce them, I wanted to close out the program with them because they so much embody all of the military. But if we're going to talk about all of the military, let's talk a bit about how America today is treating all of the military. Again, I'm old enough to remember when when it was not safe for soldiers in uniform to walk the streets of many of our cities. If they were lucky, they were merely spat upon and called baby killers. Men and women coming back from Vietnam with all of the baggage that comes from having fought in a war. Now, again, I never served. I had a couple of great uncles that served during World War II. And they never talked about it. They never talked about their engagement. I had another uncle who served in Vietnam, and he never talked about it. But there's one story in my family that I always thought was telling. After coming back from service, one of my uncles he had been cleaning up around the apartment in New York City, where he lived at the time with his mother. He lay down on the couch, take a nap. And outside, a vehicle backfired. It sounded like a gunshot. He reached over to the coffee table. He grabbed the broom that he had been using, hugged it to his chest, rolled off the couch, and rolled under the coffee table and never woke up. I remember my great-grandmother wondering, what must have it have been like that the idea of being shot at wasn't worth waking up? We ask a lot of men and women when we send them into combat. We ask them much more than I think we can even train them for. We talk about coming back, you know, wounded. We talk about coming back dead. But I don't know that we ever deal with the mental cost, the mental price paid of having to go into combat. Then to come home to a nation that is at best apathetic, at worst ungrateful, because they don't like the politics about what you were sent for. I lived through that in the 1970s. What's interesting today is, today it's not society that's spitting on our military. In many ways, it's our government. I remember when I first heard about the withdrawal from Afghanistan and how badly it was handled. And I thought about all the men and women who had fought over there, the families who had lost loved ones to that fight, only to watch us leave in such a disgraceful fashion. So one of the interesting things, again, I was a child at the time. It took a while for it to really dawn on me that from a military standpoint, the South Vietnamese had won the war with America's help. It was the political machinations that lost it. In many ways, that's just as true with Iraq and Afghanistan. But to see men and women coming home, wondering what it was all for, to me, that is a demoralizing aspect that I pray we quickly get over. Then to see the military, which has always been, you know, when you sign up for the military, you basically sign over many of your rights. You tell the government, says, you send me, you raise your right hand and say, you control my life. You tell me where to go. You tell me what to do. If you tell me to go take that hill, even though it may cost my life, I am legally and honor bound to do it. That's why I say they pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. They risk their life to protect us and our way of life. They generally get paid very little. And, you know, the stories of enlisted personnel, how many of them need food stamps just to feed their families? They're pledging their fortune to keep us safe, to keep our Constitution and our way of life safe. Their honor. Honor is still a big deal in the military. It seems to have been lost in much of, at least in a lot of the society we read about, we hear about, although I do believe honor still exists in most of the heartland of the country. But the idea of honor seems to be so much a part of the military ethos. And then to have them question, was it worth it? Was the pain I went through worth it? Was the sacrifice I went through worth it? Seeing my friends die, seeing themselves amputees, injured physically, mentally, was it worth it? And the only thing I can say is, from a grateful nation, if not from a grateful government, yes, it was worth it. The government may make mistakes. The people may make mistakes. But I think we need to honor these men and women that have sacrificed so much for us. I want to look them in the eye and say, it's worth it. I want to see a person in uniform and walk up to them and shake their hand and say, thank you. Not simply a passing thank you for your service. That's one thing. I want to shake their hand and say thank you. I want to buy them a meal. I want to honor the sacrifice they're willing to make because they do sacrifice. And then to have a government turn around and say, okay, you volunteered to serve. We have a voluntary army. I believe the draft is unconstitutional. It deprives people of their lives, their liberty, and their property without due process of law. But to, in a time of a volunteer military, to say, not only do you have to sacrifice, you want to sacrifice your life, to give up your right to live where you want, do what you want, but to become a medical guinea pig. Ladies and gentlemen, dude, that's a step too far. When the Marine Corps, as I read one article, says, you want to be a Marine, take the jab or get out. To me, that's dishonorable. For a part of the military so dedicated to honor, protecting their honor, to treat Marines so dishonorably, it's a sad state of affairs. And as much as we like to look at what Washington, D.C. is doing, remember, they're doing it because we hired them. We hired those men and women to do our, to exercise our power in our name, to represent us. The disgrace is not simply Washington's. The disgrace is ours. And I believe we owe these men and women and their families so much more. One day a year with parades, maybe laying of a few wreaths and saying of a few words, I don't think that's enough. I think the sacrifices are too great. I think what's being asked of them today by their military leadership is dishonorable. I believe it is up to the American people to do a better job. To look at these men and women and their families. We focus on the men and women, but very often families carry this load as well. From being away from loved ones, from worrying about loved ones that are potentially in combat, from missed opportunities to be in a career where you make more money and you live a more comfortable life, to being shuffled around the world on a moment's notice. Families are part of this as well. One of the things I remember at a church I used to attend before I moved down south is a family member had a relative that was serving in Afghanistan. And we would collect little things, little snacks, little personal hygiene, items that we would send them in care packages. We didn't know most of the people we were sending these packages to, but we recognized the need of helping them overseas. But I think we forgot the families. We got wonderful responses, men and women that were just so thankful that we were thinking of them and praying for them and giving them these little things. I wonder, did we forget the families? Did we forget to come alongside the wife, the husband, the child, the mother, the father, and support them as well? So on this Veterans Day, please join me. Stand. Put your hand over your heart. Pledge to honor the men and women who serve this country, who have pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to defend the Constitution that we hold so dear, to support their families while they're away, and if necessary, support them in their grief. Support them in the work of taking care of a wounded loved one, whether that wound be physical or mental. let us honor the men and women who have done us the honor of protecting our Constitution and our way of life. Let Veterans Day not simply be a date on a calendar. Let it be a reminder, an annual reminder of our duty, our sacred duty, to honor those who are willing to fight and die for us, who are willing to do what most of us are unwilling to do. That's what Veterans Day should be about. If there's a veteran in your family, or if you're a veteran yourself, I thank you. I honor you. I wish I could shake your hand. If you know a veteran, please take this as an opportunity to remind yourself to thank a veteran, however you can. Not in passing, not as an afterthought. Take a little time, look them in the eye, give them a firm handshake, and a heartfelt thank you. Thank you. What can we do to help? Now, before I go, I want to remind you that the America Out Loud Talk Radio plays on the iHeartRadio network. You can also listen on our media player from any web browser anywhere in the world. We have best-in-class apps on Apple, Android, and Alexa, where you can stream 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, podcasts included on those same apps. So please check that out and join me in saluting all of our military as we head out with Marine Corps hymn.